And it is Dads on the Air, this 26th day of June 2012, and welcome to the program. We've got, as usual, a great big show today. We will be crossing to the United States later on, and we'll be speaking to our two guests over there. We'll be speaking with Jill Ajizi, and later on we'll be speaking with Karen Lebo. Jill Ajizi is a real activist in the States in the area of parental alienation. And Karen has set up the International Support Network for Alienated Families, and they have a conference coming up later in the year. So this is our parental alienation show, and you're going to find out a lot about the whole topic of parental alienation, which is such an important one and is experienced by parents all over the world. So this is a show not to be missed. So we've also got some interesting music choices, as usual. So it's going to be a great show today. Now, as in accordance with usual practice, we'll just mention a few news items that have caught our eye in the last week or so. Here's one that seems to raise its head very often, periodically in any event. This is an article posted on the 23rd of June 2012, and it talks about the wage gap myth. The Equal Opportunity for Women in the Workplace Agency, EOWA, has issued a media release claiming that Australian workplaces discriminate against women because of an average gender wage difference between male and female graduates of $2,000. The source data cited actually found this difference was not due to discrimination at all, but in fact it's due to the fields of study chosen by males and females, along with other factors such as hours worked, type and location of employer. I think you would be very hard-pressed to find any job in Australia where they said if you're a male you get so much, if you're a female you get the other one, it's so much less. I mean, for one thing, it's illegal, but that doesn't stop people coming out with these sorts of statements. The Helen Conway, who is the director of EOWA, claimed, at this stage, there is no clear evidence that there is any statistical correlation between these other factors. The factors being the fields of study chosen by males and other factors such as hours worked and type and location of employer. And the differences, and she says there's no statistical correlation. So in her view, in the circumstances, it is not unreasonable to conclude that prima facie discrimination is the reason for the anomaly. Well, unfortunately, Ms. Conway appears to be ignorant of the research on this issue. The Graduate Careers Australia GCA Graduate Salaries 2009 report conducted extensive research on this very issue and found that there was indeed a statistical correlation between the gender wage gap and broad field of education, personal characteristics, enrolment characteristics, and other employment characteristics. It found that female graduates earned an average hourly starting salary 3% less than their male counterparts after controlling for a range of factors. And it also pointed out the finding suggests that female graduates did not have the same access to higher paid positions. But note that the GCA did not actually find any evidence of this. They just assumed it to be the case. Another likely explanation is that there are many other factors which GCA wasn't able to test for, which can explain the small 3% gender gap for new graduates. These were covered in great detail in Warren Farrell's book, Why Men Earn More. And it's just common sense, but if you look at some of these factors, women commonly prefer jobs with shorter and more flexible hours to accommodate the demands of family. Compared to men, they generally favour jobs that involve little danger, no travel, little financial risk, and good social skills. And those types of jobs generally pay less. And just as a couple of examples, you work on an oil rig, you get lots of money. Very few women, in fact, having worked in that industry, I can say there were no women applications, no women applicants for jobs on the oil rigs. You look at some professions, the police force, nursing. These sorts of jobs traditionally don't pay as well as other jobs, but there's no discrimination between whether you're a male or a female, a policeman or a nurse. So it's amazing the way this whole argument seems to have migrated across to from saying in the same job you get different rates of pay to between one type of employment and another type of employment. And I don't think we're ever going to get equal pay for all the different types of employment that are available out there. Now, this is an article from the UK. They've actually set out 13 reasons why it's unlucky to be a man. Now, before I go on with this, I think I've forgotten to mention that we, once again this week on the panel, we have Bob Brown. So Bob Brown stepped into the chair. Here he is waving, all those who've got the video on. It's great to have Bob helping out with us again today. And don't forget, yes, it's my name is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. So if any of you would like to get us a message, you can go to the 89.3 website and you can get a message to us that way. Or you can always go to the Dads on the Air website. And don't forget our new address. It's www.dadsontheair.com.au, where you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. So we'd love to hear from you. If you've got any comments on the show or any topics you particularly like us to investigate, we're always pleased to hear from you. So going back to the 13 reasons it's unlucky to be a man, as noted in the UK, first of all, is the one we're all pretty aware of, is the life expectancy. From the moment they are born, boys all over the world are destined to live shorter lives. In Swaziland, boys have who at 31 years have a life expectancy 56 years shorter than girls born in Japan, who will expect to live to 87. That's dreadful, isn't it? Swaziland, a life expectancy for boys of only 31 years. In the UK, in the city of Brighton and Hove, boys from the poorer neighbourhoods die 13 years sooner than girls from the richer areas. And yet, strangely enough, women's projects still receive 13 times more funding than men's projects. Amazingly, girls in Iraq, who have a life expectancy of 71.3, girls in India have a life expectancy of 72.6, girls in Indonesia have a life expectancy of 73.4, but a boy born in East Brighton has only 70.9. So a boy born in the UK has a lower life expectancy than girls in Iraq, India or Indonesia. Education, we do hear a little bit about this. Boys now underperform girls at every stage of education. They are less likely to attend university and four times more likely to be permanently excluded from school. This is an issue which is particularly troublesome for boys, as 90% of boys aged 15 to 18 in prison were excluded from school, compared with 40% of girls. So excluded boys and girls are 19 times more likely to commit suicide, and there's a higher... So one thing just leads to another there, starting with the underperforming boys in education, and that's something that really has to be addressed. In employment, in general, men do get paid more, but they also work longer hours, take less time off sick, throw less sickies, and when they're out of work, men are three times more likely to be on job seekers allowance and looking for work. Men are 50% more likely to work full-time, three times more likely to be self-employed, and when they have children, mums are four times more likely to not be working than dads. And strangely enough, this is often also thrown up, but research shows that men do more than their fair share of household and domestic chores. While men are on average are pulling their weight at home and putting more hours in at work, women are twice as likely to be economically inactive and are more likely to be being taken care of financially by a partner, an ex-partner, or the big one, the state. The state all around the world seems to want to jump into the parenting role and tell these mothers that they don't actually need a dad or a father in the family. They can we'll look after you. And we see that very right in many societies around the world. Now, another factor that's come up, of course, is violence. We've talked on this program many times in the past. You have the excellent website in Australia, the 1 in 3 website. If you want to get the real figures on domestic violence, go to 1 in 3. You can either type in the numbers or the words, and you'll see the actual research figures rather than the nonsense that's spewed out by groups such as the White Ribbon Campaign and many of these government campaigns against domestic violence. The reality is that men and boys are twice as likely to be victims of violence than women and girls. Internationally, two-thirds of the 1.6 million people who die of violent deaths every year are men and boys. And yet the United Nations coverage on violent deaths fails to even mention that men are the biggest victims. And its subsequent poster campaign on ending violent deaths, it chose four images of women and just two of a man. Since this was highlighted, the World Health Organization has updated the page's reference to include men, although the primary focus is still violence against just women. Never mind the men, never mind the kids. And this is the same all over the world. There's no international campaign to stop violence against men and boys. And there just seems to be resistance to acknowledge, both in the UK, certainly in Australia, that that some 40% of domestic violence victims are male. And then once you get past the violence, there's no service for male victims. And so it's no wonder that there's a very high dark figure here of men who are too embarrassed, too afraid to tell anyone about the abuse they experience. We've heard cases of police laughing at men when they arrive in a police station to report violence by their female partner. This one-sided approach to the issue seems to be all around the world. In 2008-2009 in the UK, 71% of murder victims were male. Men are also three times more likely to be killed by a stranger. Now, you'd never think that if you looked at the campaigns on violence and domestic violence. Even more worrying is the work done on early intervention to change children's attitudes, because the studies have shown that girls are far more tolerant of violence against men and boys, being 11 times more likely to say it is okay for a woman to hit her partner for nagging or arguing when compared to their attitude to a man hitting a woman for the same reason. Sadly, boys seem to be growing up with an attitude that it's okay for them to be hit by their partner, being 15 times more likely than girls to think it's okay for their partner to hit them. So we've got a long way to go in changing the society attitudes in this whole area of domestic violence. Just another area where men are falling behind women is in avoidable death. Men are more likely to die from all manner of avoidable deaths, being three times more likely to commit suicide and more likely to be suffering with serious undiagnosed illness, and accounting for over 95% of employees who are killed at work each year. More men are killed at work than women are killed at home in domestic violence incidents, and this doesn't include the hundreds of predominantly male workers in the armed forces who are killed in conflicts such as in Afghanistan. Young men are particularly vulnerable, with teenage boys and young men aged 15 to 24 in the UK are 2.5 times as likely to die young than women and girls of the same age, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation's poverty site. Now, this doesn't include all the men that die in car accidents. It doesn't include the premature deaths from cancer, where once again men are overly represented. Another area where men clearly do not fare well is in the area of fathers' rights. And this is what this program spends a lot of time dealing with. And it's also a focus of a group in America called Artists Against Misandry. And we just happen to have a music track ready here. This is a track by a group called 17 Stories. We've been talking to Jade Michael about this band, and the song itself is called One Life. So we'll have our short music break and we'll be back shortly. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Dad's on the Air this 26th day of June 2012. We were just running through some 13 items where men seem to get the rough end of the pineapple. There are just a couple more here that we talk about. Obviously, father's rights as far as children. When you know, all around the world, you'll find that the men don't get the equal share time with their children after separation. In the UK, the Institute's Family Fairness Index shows just one in nine UK dads having the opportunity to continue sharing the parenting of their children after separation. Sweden is a little bit better, one in three, still not great. Certainly in Australia, it's the same situation where there is, after separation, not many dads get to have equal shared time with their children. And, of course, what happens then is around a third of the children have contact with their parents with that non-resident parent once a week. A third, 35% see dad less than once a week, and another third have sadly no contact at all. I've mentioned cancer. I might just there are a few others there pointed out, but I'll just get on to another story here, which was referring to the Father's Day downer in the USA. where one of our favourite people, Barbara Kay, has written an article for the New York Daily News on Sunday, June 17. And she notes that there have been some recent loving, engaged portrayals of fathers in recent popular movies like The Descendants, Moneyball and A Better Life. All three performances were nominated for Academy Awards. So you might think that culturally American dads are being culturally valued. But look again, what's happened? The usual story. The mothers in these films are either comatose, divorced or dead. No coincidence. There's an unspoken Hollywood rule that fathers can't shine too brightly in the face of active mothering. Dads are more likely to be accorded respect when they are coping, in effect, when they are surrogate mothers. And that's the cultural representation. And then so you might say, well, why do fathers matter so much? The reason is because fatherhood makes men out of boys, for one thing. And typically they offer children what they offer children is just as necessary, but a different kind of love and guidance from what mothers bestow. When fathers are not there, the absence is absolutely devastating for children. Exhaustive peer-reviewed research confirms that the absence of a father is the single most reliable predictor for a whole roster of negative outcomes. Low self-esteem, parental alienation, high school dropout. 71% of those who drop out of high school are fatherless. Truancy, early sexual activity, promiscuity, teen pregnancy, gang membership, imprisonment. 85% of jailed youth are fatherless. Drug abuse, homelessness. It just goes on and on. And yet in America, 84% of custodial parents are mothers, a figure that hasn't budged in three decades. You might think, well, what happens when the families are motherless, as distinct? I mean, clearly, we know what happens when they're fatherless. But strangely enough, there is no evidence regarding the effect of motherlessness. Nevertheless, female superiority in parenting remains an article of faith among the courts and among the many people who call themselves the intellectual elites. And this goes through to the judges who simply channel their bias. In America, President Obama has recently had a much hyped interactive web-based campaign ad called The Life of Julia, no relation to our own Julia Gillard, I presume. The ad tracks the stages of one single woman's life and is aimed at a rising demographic because there are 10 million more single women in America than there are single men. And cynically, you might say that this population trends leftward in their voting pattern, so maybe some assistance to President Obama in the forthcoming election. In the The Life of Julia campaign, Julia has a child, but there's no father in the ad. The ad implies that with the aid of government, women can enjoy secure lives as single mothers at no cost or personal sacrifice. And implicit is the assumption that Julia's child won't suffer either. So this is President Obama's hubby state, a particularly cynical policy path given the personal experience and knowledge of a president who was abandoned by his own father as a child. The state, you'd have to say, makes a lousy father. But Barbara Kay, in this article, believes that there are encouraging signs that the pendulum is beginning to swing back to reason and fairness. We can only hope in Australia. But she points to what's happening in the UK, where the government seems to have come to its senses after that ridiculous report they commissioned, because they can't ignore the social costs of fatherlessness. The British government has announced that from this point forward, the preferred option in family court will be the presumption that a child's welfare is likely to be furthered through safe involvement with both parents. In the absence of abuse, equal parenting will be the default custodial arrangement. We can only give three cheers for that. It'll be fantastic when this is actually brought in and we get some proper research done, because it might start a snowball. And it might even spread to Australia and some of the other countries that suffer under this sexism that we experience in the family courts. Now, I might just mention too, it's a theme that we often come back to, and that's in relation to international parental child abduction. There's a case recently involving a Canadian man by the name of Stephen Watkins, who's become caught up in this international parental child abduction. In his case, his two boys were abducted from Canada with the mother. The mother fled to Poland, despite the fact that that he had been awarded sole custody of the boys, mainly for the reason that the mother was physically and mentally abusing the boys while in her care. Nevertheless, she has held onto the passports. She was actually ordered by the Ontario courts to hand over those passports, but she held onto them. She took flight, went to Poland, and it gets worse because the Polish court has refused to return the children, the Canadian children, back to Canada. They've in fact used some loophole in the Hague Convention Treaty. The father, Stephen Watkins, took it on appeal, but the Polish courts once again have dismissed the appeal and denied the return of the two missing abducted children back to Canada from Poland. This has been taken up in Canada by the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, and there have been questions on this raised on this because it now is a high-profile international child abduction case. So while this mother who's... And it only came to the attention of the authorities in Poland because, once again, the mother... A very difficult name to pronounce, Edyta Ustasiuska, was physically and mentally abusing the boys even while she was in Poland. And when this was reported, one thing led to another, and they found out that the children were wanted for this international abduction. Not that Australia's got much to be proud of. We've still got this case going with those four children in Brisbane. It's going to be before the High Court in August. And we can only hope that the law is followed, apart from the common sense position regarding the international abduction of these children by one of the parents and flouting all the laws of the land. So we might go to a short music break before we come back with our first guest, who is going to be Jill Ejizi, who's president of the Parental Alienation Awareness Organisation and a recognised author from the US. So we'll go to our music break right now.
Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. One parent disappears by elimination through misinformation with lots of fabrication. Little brains are wired by constant stimulation against the other parent with great determination. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. No more expectation of parents' visitation. Nothing is now positive, only denigration. All attempted contact create a complication. Memories are erased with determined application. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation.
degradation is practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. We don't see it, children, despite our protestation. The court will not act to judge. Dare to speak out, you invite recrimination, which destroys your reputation by nasty imputation. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. This must be exposed, cause a revelation, as this is child abuse, a cruel abomination. The courts must stand up to save their reputation. Eliminate this practice of parental alienation. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. This practice by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air. That was Parental Alienation by our own Peter Vandervoort, Rockin' Pop. And that's from his album called Our Stolen Children. So you can Google that and find out a bit more about Peter Vandervoort. Now, just before we go to our first guest, I should also have a big cheerio to Whiskers, who rang in, and he's listening today. So g'day, Whiskers. Now, we are going to cross to Springfield, in the state, which is the state capital of Illinois in the USA, and we are speaking with Jill Ajizi, who is an old woman in Illinois and very accomplished and active. We'll be going through some of all the activities that Jill's been engaging in lately in a moment. So, Jill, good morning.
Good morning. How are you down under?
Oh, we're battling on. We're in winter here, so it's a bit colder, I imagine, than it is in Chicago.
Yes, well, it was 96 here today, so we're having quite a time with the weather. Everything is upside down, not quite what it's supposed to be in the United States as far as weather goes, so we're not very happy about that.
Yeah, 96, so that's probably about 36 degrees in the way we measure it, but that's whatever
exactly.
Way you measure it, it's hot. So, Jill, you've got a very busy background. You started off you were an alienated mother some 9 years ago, and then you decided to actually do something about it, and you've been working in this area very actively ever since.
Well, I have, and I decided when it began to happen to me, and I didn't quite know what it was, and I Googled and Googled and Googled, and you find all of this great information that's out there. And 9 years ago, it was a minimal amount of great information, and I realized that there was a name for what was happening to me, and I started to research and find answers, because I believe that it's so important to have all the answers for what's happening to you so you can be an articulate advocate for yourself and for your child. And I was sad. I am still sad, but I am not the kind of person that sits around and whines and cries about what's happening to me, and I jump immediately into activism. So I made a phone call, tried to find Alec Baldwin in hopes that he would call me back. He did. We became friends. We began working on things, and it was a sort of a catapult into the parental alienation arena for me.
Yes, I've read Alec Baldwin's book, and I found
a great book,
and he manages to discuss the problem without focusing on the individual. I mean, he's very he doesn't really say anything bad, terribly bad about his ex-wife. He doesn't.
But I'll tell you something interesting about that book. He wrote it sort of in a way that every character in the book is Alec, so every situation that is in the book is about something that happened to him, but he wrote it sort of in the third person so that he wouldn't be incriminating in his own legal battles.
Yes. Yes, he would have sealed sections, say, well, I can't talk about that, but then he would talk about other aspects and certainly set out the problem. And you know, you really feel for him, you know, when he was, because he's so well known, you know, walking down the street and people would be calling out things to him, and it must have been a dreadful experience for him.
Very dreadful, yeah. But tonight I see he's getting married, so I think he's very happy, and he has a relationship with his daughter, and that's how parental alienation turns out in a good way. But you and I both know that there are so many cases where there are people that don't see their children like me, like hundreds of thousands of other people in the United States and globally. So it's a very sad proposition for some people.
That's right. I mean, Amy Baker, who I think you've also had something to do with in her book, The Ties That Bind, I think she said the average period for parental alienation is something like 20 years. So it doesn't really encourage it, does it? But
not encouraging at all. But I think, you know, with people like Amy, I have Amy actually coming to Chicago this Saturday. So if there's anybody listening that's in the United States that can get to Chicago on Saturday, I have Amy Baker coming to speak, and Brian Ludmer, who's a terrific attorney from Canada, who will be speaking about parental alienation all day Saturday, and it's going to be a great, great day, I think.
Yes, I've heard both them speaking. They're both fantastic, and it's going to be an extended session. You're not going to have one speaker on for an hour and then another speaker. They're going to be having day long sessions. Is that the way you're planning it?
Yes. In the morning, Amy is 9 to 1, and then Brian is 1:30 to 4. So it's going to be an all day thing, and you can register for either session. But I'm encouraging people. I don't know why you'd leave. You know, you need to stay the whole day and kind of listen to what they have to say, Brian. Brian Ludmer has a terrific protocol for questioning for an alienator in a courtroom setting, and these questions really put that alienator in a box and really show them to be what they are. And that's what attorneys need to realize, is that you've got to ask the right questions to these people in a court, because if you don't, they are lawless people who will run over everything, and you know it as well as I do. And I'm sure it's I hear Australia is a hotbed of parental alienation, just like it is in Illinois and Maine and Florida and California and every other state and Canada. You know, every place that I have contacts, it's just as bad in family courts. But if you can get the right line of questioning and put and frame the case the right way, and Brian seems to be able to do that, very successful at what he does. 33% of the cases that he handled last year in Canada returned those children to their target parents.
That's a great strike rate. Yes, the problem we have in Australia is just recognising that it actually exists. So I think we're at least one step behind the US and Canada in the area of parental alienation.
Well, I know if you keep doing what you're doing, and I mean, the louder we speak, the more they will hear. And I think that eventually, you know, when I started this 9 years ago, there, as I said, minimal information, very quiet. And we have gone from baby steps to giant strides in America and really in North America. And now people are listening, legislators are listening. For the first time ever, on April 25th this year, Illinois, my state, and Pennsylvania, where we have a very strong parental alienation awareness organization chapter, declared a month-long parental alienation awareness month. So legislators are listening. I had to go and testify before the Illinois legislature to make that happen, and the room was silent. You could hear a pin drop. And when I said, I'm an alienated mother, there was a gasp, because the face of alienation, people think you have to look like, you know, some horrible person with horns and a tail. They don't understand that it's just your everyday soccer mom and your dad that just wants time with his kids. And so when they see the vast and varied faces of parental alienation, and that it can be somebody like me or somebody like you, they understand that this is something that could happen to them.
Yes, and perhaps before we go any further, could you just describe in a little bit more detail what parental alienation is and how you see it?
Absolutely. Simply put, it's when one parent turns the children against the other parent and his or her family, and usually it's in an adversarial divorce setting. However, it can happen in an intact marriage. It can happen with grandparents can be the alienators, step-parents can be the alienators. So in most cases, it's an adversarial divorce, and the children are being turned against one parent or the other.
Yes, and it's not something that's reasonable. It's a totally unreasonable turning off of the other parent, and it demonstrates itself in various ways with the children, I think, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And there's many things that you can say that it is not, you know, but what it is an inexplainable action by a child against the parent, and there's no rhyme nor reason for it. It's parents who've had loving, wonderful relationships with their children that, in my case, 4 weeks, 6 days is all it took to turn 4 kids against me and my entire family. So it can happen quickly. It's a swift, you know, if a judge can't make a swift decision, that is the friend of an alienator. There's so many things that are contributory to it happening. And it doesn't matter if you're in Australia or Japan or Illinois or California. If you lose your relationship with a child, you are losing something so wonderful, and that child is losing half of themselves. And unfortunately, the dramatic, devastating effects of that are long-lasting self-esteem issues, trust. They have no trust for any type of relationship that they're having. 48% of these kids don't want to get married. And they just can't have meaningful relationships. Mm. And if these alienators understood what they were doing to these kids for the rest of their lives, maybe they would stop. I don't know. They're so sick and so just sociopathic and narcissistic and all of the psychological terms that you can apply to these people. I think back about what Craig Childress and I talked about, Dr. Craig Childress, and I don't know if you're familiar with him, but just an outstanding guy in Pasadena, California, who's doing revolutionary things in the parental alienation treatment arena. But he says that you can almost always pinpoint some trauma in an alienator's life from childhood or adolescence that makes them behave the way they do. Mm-hmm. And it's really true.
That's interesting. So we have to go back a bit before we're going to solve this problem to try and find out what the original problem that led to the parental alienation to start with.
Right.
And
right.
Jill, do you find being a female, does that have a bigger effect when people, you mentioned before, you know, they might see a parental alienation situation as they might see the target parent as traditionally being a male who's perhaps done something wrong? Whereas they look at you.
I think what you're saying is absolutely correct, although I would never want to slight any of the fathers that are looking to regain relationships with their children, because I could line them up from Maine to California and from Florida all the way to Canada, you know, and beyond. But I will tell you that I think there is a stronger stigma attached to the kind of screwed up look that you get when you say you're an alienated mother, because being a mother and not having your children is, in the United States anyway, and maybe you can tell me in Australia what the kind of thought process is, but for so many years the mother was assumed to be able to get the child in court. Mm-hmm. And that's how it worked here, and that's sort of what judges have ingrained in their minds here. But as progressive as we like to think we are, you know, people still are thinking that what's wrong with you if you're a mother without your children? Mm. And it is a huge stigma, and it's very, very sad. I was a custodial mom, so I'm a little bit of an enigma in that whole scene, but certainly moms have a little bit tougher road to hoe, I think, because of that issue.
And you're the mother of, I think, 4 children. And were they were all alienated?
All alienated, and I should say that my two older children were not my biological children. Their mother had died. I raised them from the ages of 2 and 9 months. And so they were mine. You know, I raised them. I instilled morals, character, belief, Christian beliefs, all of the things that I felt, you know, a mother should be doing when raising children, and then had two biological children of my own. And, they are all severely alienated and don't see them. And I really, they're all over 18 now, and I really... I'm very, very sad about it, but as you know, if you allow this thing called parental alienation to consume you, it will kill you. So you cannot dwell and think about that issue every moment. Do you think about the great memories? Of course. Can I tell you I don't cry? No, I can't tell you that. Can I tell you I'm not sad? No, can't tell you that either. But what I can tell you is these children now are over 18, and I will wait patiently every day for that knock on the door. The two people that I feel saddest for right now the most are my parents. My father was a former United States congressman. My mother, one of the best homemakers and cooks and moms in the whole wide world, had a great childhood, couldn't be a better one. And they are missing out on a relationship with their loving grandparents, and my parents are 76 and 72, and they're not going to be around forever. And I hate that they are losing that half of their heritage and all of the stories that my dad can tell so well.
Yes, it extends just way beyond the alienated parent. I mean, it even extends to the family pet gets ostracized. All sorts of things, weird
Absolutely.
Things happen, don't they?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So now you've started this parental awareness, parental alienation awareness day, which I think you mentioned before was 25th of April.
Well, and I have to absolutely give credit where credit is due. Parental Alienation Awareness Organization and the day and the Bubbles of Love campaign were all ideas and founded by Sarvi Emo in Toronto, Canada, about 10 years ago. And she has done a terrific job. I took over as president 2 years ago and have tried to grow the organization in a different way by spreading the word a little more and creating some chapters that I feel it's a very strong issue to have a grassroots campaign going with this awareness and education that we create every day. Because if we don't have people in the trenches, if it's just me and it's just you, I'm doing my radio show, you're doing yours, that's not enough. There is too much work to be done without having these soldiers or ambassadors, as I call them, out there telling people what this is, why it's bad, and how we can stop it.
Yes, and awareness is such a major part of that. Now, I noticed that you mentioned Sarvi Emo, and she had contact with Dr. Walshak, who we've had on this program, and he's an absolute leader in this field.
He's a great guy, absolutely. Yeah. Richard's a good friend.
Oh, that's well, lucky you. He suggested, I think he was the one who suggested moving Awareness Day to April 25, and then and for some reason I've got a note here that says that Sarvi regretted this decision. Was there some reason why she regretted moving it to April 25?
Well, no, I think, you know, and I don't know the whole story, so I'm not going to speak out of turn, but I think something about April 25th was, I think it is Roger Van Maris, who is Sarvi's boyfriend and partner for life. His children were the alienated children, and that's why Sarvi did this. And she chose his birthday. Is April 25th, I believe, is Roger's birthday, and I could be telling the completely wrong story, but I think that's right. So, but April 25th, let me tell you, has been a successful, successful day this year. We had more proclamations proclaimed throughout the world proclaiming Awareness Day, and Bubbles of Love campaign, which is the campaign that goes along with that day where everyone blows bubbles at noon in their respective time zones. We had more Bubbles of Love events than any other time that we've ever had. So the word is getting out. People are doing things. And things like this for awareness, creating awareness, are terrific, because guess what happens when you go out and blow bubbles with 200 people? Guess who comes? The news media comes.
Yes.
And it gets on TV. And in San Diego, we had it in Spanish and English. And in Illinois, we had it on Channel 20 News. And, I mean, it's amazing. The bubbles attract the people and attract the news media. So it is a terrific campaign.
Yes, look, we'd love to be part of the campaign, but we have a problem, because 25th of April is probably the most sacred day in the Australian calendar. It's our Anzac Day, in which we commemorate all the times around the world where Australian soldiers have gone off to fight. And it's actually growing in Australia. I think it sort of went through a period where people didn't want to be associated with war, but now it seems to be focusing on the men who gave their lives and fought. And I'd have to say the chances of getting any other day up on 25th of April are absolutely minimal. So I don't know what we're going to do.
Why don't we say that in Australia we'll make it April 24th?
That's something. Yes, if we could do that, just change it a little bit from the 25th of April, we've got a chance of getting up, and maybe we could even somehow link it with the sacrifices that the soldiers did. I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head here, but we would love to be a part of this whole awareness day thing, because it's even more important.
I think that
would
be amazing. And you know, here's the thing: in the United States, soldiers are one of the biggest groups of people who lose contact with their children when they go off to war, come back, and their kids are gone, their wife has left them, they've married someone else, or they're trying to divorce them. They never see their kids again. And it also is the largest suicide rate. So tying the two together, I see no problem with that at all, because really they're intertwined in a very sort of odd way.
Yes, so I think that gives us some possibilities there. And look, we talked about your conference coming up. I wonder, could you tell us a little bit about your radio show?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we have a radio show on Wednesday nights. In fact, this coming Wednesday is a really interesting show. I have an actor that you guys may not know in Australia, but here he's pretty popular, Brian McLaughlin. And Brian was taken by his father at the age of 3, told his mother was in a mental institution and that she had died, never had contact with her again, although she searched and searched and searched for him. And finally, later, much later in life, in his 40s, he found his mom. And he wrote a book called Have You Seen My Mother?
Yes.
And he is on Wednesday night. And we try to, I mean, the show was obviously born out of a need for parental alienation, awareness, and education. But we've had people on like Bill Hudson, who's Goldie Hawn's ex-husband. Kate and Oliver Hudson are his children. He hasn't seen them in many, many years. Christy Swanson, who, if you know the movie Buffy the Vampire Slayer,
yes, yes,
she was Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Ah.
She is an adult child of alienation and married to Lloyd Eisler, who is a Canadian Olympic skater who is currently experiencing alienation. So we try to keep that theme, you know, because it's so important. And it's just, there are too many people that want to be on the show. And I think that's the saddest part of all. We can have a show about parental alienation and fill every single spot, and I think it's so sad.
Yeah, so your radio show is just dedicated solely to parental alienation.
It is. I mean, we've talked about family issues, obviously, but it seems to always kind of come back around to that. You know, we're open to anything having to do with divorce, family issues, but I mean, that's what Judge Michelle Lawrence is my co-host. And thank God for this woman, because when I found Michelle, when we found each other, and we say we're stuck together like glue, she is a sitting family court judge in Illinois, Cook County, the largest family court system in the world. And she is doing just amazing things in her courtroom with people that pass by her bench to people that are divorcing, people experiencing alienation. We got her appointed by the Supreme Court of Illinois to teach all of the judges in Illinois, all the family court judges, about parental alienation and visitation interference. So things are happening here, and she is doing amazing, amazing things in working toward a change in divorce culture here in Illinois. And that seems to be spreading. We just released our workbook for alienated parents, Parental Alienation 911. And the only publication ever written about parental alienation by a sitting family court judge and an advocate. So a lot of things are going on. But the show, syndicatednews.net, is on, and it's an amazing station. The guy that owns it is John McCune, the founder of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and his partner, Ruthie DiTucci. Yeah, they're great people. They do a great job. We have Alec Baldwin's show on. We have a really lot of high-profile people on, but we're one of the original shows. Our show's called Family Matters, and we're really proud of what we're doing there and trying to create awareness. I just saw a post on Facebook. A great advocate from Japan posted, Kevin Pedersen posted, that he put up a link to my show, and it's been one of the most popular links ever, and it was one of the best shows with Brian Ludmer. So, you know, it's just doing what we do. Michelle and I don't get paid for anything we do, and we just want to make a difference. As does Brian, as does Amy, you know, everybody. It's such a big, small world of parental alienation. As you know, there's only a handful of people that deal with this issue.
Yes, and you are making a difference. And with Judge Michelle Lawrence, who, as I've mentioned to you, we'd like to get you both back on to talk about the parental alienation 911 handbook.
We'd love it.
And you've also got The Look of Love as your that's your novel.
I do, and I sent you a link, but you couldn't open it, so the hardcover is coming to you. Yes, okay. The Look of Love is a novel written as a novel. It is a really great story about a woman who loses her children to parental alienation. It mimics my own story, and it's a great book. It's done its job on it's been on Dr. Phil and The View and all over the place, and so it's doing what it was supposed to do, getting into the hands of people who don't understand parental alienation.
That's fantastic. So look, I'll just mention a couple of these sites for your workbook. It's www.parentalalienation911.net, and then for your radio show, it's www.syndicatednews.net, and they can find you. We'll have the links on our website as well. Jill, I'm sure we could talk for a long time. There's so many things that are happening, but we've run out of time. So I wanted to throw now, you asked if we could pick a powerful song. Well, I think this is a powerful song, and it's got an Australian connection. This is a song called Going Back by Glenn Shorrock and Renee Geyer. So, Jill Ejizi, thank you very much for being on the show, and we wish you all the very best for the work you're doing and for your conference on Saturday. Once again, we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us, and I look forward to hearing from you again, and good on you for what you're doing.
Thanks, Jill.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
But thinking young and growing older,
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air this 26th day of June 2012. At least it is in Australia, Tuesday, 26th June. And our next guest is Karen Lebo, a social worker, founder and CEO and president of the International Support Network for Alienated Families. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
So it's very nice to hear you. And we're talking to you from Los Angeles, I think.
Yes, in that area. The sound is a little bit soft, so if I get it wrong, you'll correct me, right?
Oh, yes. No, you're coming through loud and clear. You're coming through loud and clear.
I'm sorry?
You are coming through loud and clear, so I hope you can hear me okay.
Good. Excellent.
So, Karen, you founded this the International Support Network for Alienated Families, ISNAF. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit about what led you to found this network?
Yes, certainly. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was surfing the web looking for resources. Resources meaning looking for programs or literature on parental alienation or other alienated parents. I didn't know what the word for it was, but I knew that my children somehow, without me being aware, had been ripped away from me. And so, at any rate, I found Amy Baker, who wrote the book about, Breaking the Ties That Bind, which is a story of adult children who grew up in alienated, conflicted homes where parental alienation syndrome persisted, and they lived in the midst of it. And so I did not expect Dr. Baker to pick up the telephone. I thought I'd leave a message, and she would call. It was her office. And I called her, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, she picked up the phone. and we had a chat. And my background is in organizing groups and doing work with difficult families. In fact, I have graduate degrees in the subject and so forth and so on. So you'd think it would not happen to me. This alienation stuff, and it certainly did. And so she said, Karen, you organize a support group, because I was asking her for a support group. She said, there is nothing, and that was 8 years ago. She said, there is nothing where we could put you in a program or connect you up with a program, sad to say. Well, then we started with three people in someone's living room, just talking amongst us, and we were there together for over 3 hours, just being ourselves and talking about our experiences. And
that wasn't at 2 o'clock in the morning. I hope that was a more civilized hour.
No. This was a few months later.
Yes.
At any rate, we became very bonded, and we decided that we needed a safe place to at least talk about our experience and to see what we could do about it. And so we started with three people, and a few weeks later we had well over 50, and then 100, and then we had an annual conference the following year, and support groups, and so the rest is history.
And that's great history.
There's something wrong with the connection, but at any rate, in every family situation, if people talk about their experience in life, I have this hunch that someone has been alienated from a child, and in our country, the statistics show that 20,000 people that are there are 20,000 new cases a year of parental alienation syndrome that are attached to divorce statistics. But in our world, in this country at least, there are not a lot of people who are newly married who actually have traditional marriages. Only 23% go into traditional marriages. So there are people who live together as couples in long-term relationships and have children, but are never married, so they're never attached to any marital or divorce statistics. Mm. So we know the numbers are huge, just absolutely huge.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, there would be that dark figure there as well. And now, just going back to your own background, you're a social worker. You mentioned I think you've got two master's degrees and an honorary doctorate. Did any of these courses touch on parental alienation?
Actually, it wasn't that we avoided it. We were totally blindsided, ignorant. We did not have information about it. I know that there had been some earlier research, but never any programs addressing it, and still it's a controversial kind of thing where, although we know, those of us who have experienced it as parents and as children, that it exists without question, that there are many people, both in and out of the courts, who don't give it any credence at all, and they feel it's all nonsense, you know.
Yes.
But we know that it exists, and it's a good thing that we know that, because now perhaps we can do something about it.
Yes, and something has to be done about it. You mentioned Dr. Amy Baker and her book, The Ties That Bind. She looks at the victims, the children, I think, and there's a long gap between before it's likely that they're going to see their parent, the target parent, again. Have you been lucky enough to get back in touch with your child or your children?
I have to say I didn't hear the last.
Oh, I'm just you mentioned that you're an alienated parent. Have you been able to make contact again?
I have had very, very limited experience. The last contact I had was with my youngest, and that was about a year and a half ago, and it was successful, I thought. But then she had contact with, in our case, it was, people would call it sibling alienation. It was complicated. It was two marriages, one marriage that failed, and I was blamed for, and then the children who came from that marriage, two daughters, actually recruited the younger one, and they are there's 20 years difference between the two children, but between the two families. I call them two families because I remarried after a divorce, and then we adopted a baby, an infant, and so at any rate, there were 20 years difference between the two. The families in the two, the in well the, between the two generations of family, you know. So at any rate, so that was so the two older ones recruited the younger one.
Mm. Yes, well, that does happen, doesn't it? In this area of,
yes,
parental alienation, they become,
yes,
yes, recruited. They become the henchmen, really.
Right. They become the tool.
Yeah.
So, they become the tool. They get the attention for doing that. You know, that's their, that's considered their strength in terms of, or their use in terms of the alienator.
And the alienator can just step back then, and the work's done. Doesn't have to do any more work. The children that have taken on the job will finish it. So, yeah,
right.
Very hard to fight.
Yes, it is. It's there are not even any words for it.
Mm. So you've had ongoing contact, I imagine, with Dr. Amy Baker and other experts in the area. Do you think you're making some headway in the area of parental alienation?
I have the first part about how I'm in touch with the network of experts in the field, and yes, I feel very privileged to be part of that.
Yes, and do you think you're making progress?
I feel that hopefully in my lifetime, but certainly in our children's lifetime, that things will change. I feel that way because I see some changes, however slight and not enough. It seems to be building momentum as the courts are becoming better educated and actually asking for information on the subject. Also, on the other side, it's all of us, the experts, that some of us that realize that the judges many times need to have support for making what we call counterintuitive decisions. For example, when the kid comes into court, with the insulting remarks and negativity and so forth about the targeted parent, and threatens to kill himself, and literally, and all those kinds of things if you send him back, with the targeted parent, that it takes a tremendous amount for a judge to reverse custody, for example, even if he is aware that this is a child that is deeply brainwashed and programmed, and it would be hard for anybody. But given the information, the new information that he has, it does make it a bit easier to do that. And there are actually some programs that can help deal with this here in this country. This isn't a commercial for anyone at all, but the Rachel Foundation does an excellent job, and Dr. Warshak does some work with it in that way. And there are a few. There's a family camp in existence that deals with alienation. And then there's also... what I'm saying is there are resources for the courts that didn't exist several years ago as yes. well, and they need to have the resources and the programmatic support as well as the information from the other professionals, the attorneys and the therapists and so forth. It makes their job somewhat easier, but it is. To acknowledge that it is not an easy thing to either reverse custody or expand the custodial rights of the targeted parent.
Yes, I'm sure you're very far advanced in the US from in Australia, where there's still some reluctance to even accept that parental alienation exists. So we've got a fair way to go. But just interesting, when you're talking about the brainwashing, it really brings to mind something like a cult mentality, doesn't it?
Yes. It's exactly. It is definitely a cult mentality. It's a culture of what they say, totality, in other words, one belief and black and white thinking that a parent is either good or evil, something is either purely right or wrong. It's tougher for a child because children naturally, neurologically, are not that well developed in terms of critical thinking, you know. And they naturally get their values and so forth from their parents. Who else? From friends, but mainly from parents, from adults. Adults have a powerful influence on children, for better or for worse. So they get into the habit of parroting what their parents say, using vocabulary that isn't their own, you know, and that is definitely several years beyond their age, and it's obvious. And sometimes it's not so obvious, but nevertheless, the price that these children pay is tremendous later on in life, because, like my children, they look back over their shoulder, I'm quite certain of it, and say, look at all the horrible, horrific things I said and did. I mean, adolescents normally do that as well, but not as much, not to the extent as a child who's been brainwashed and then suddenly wakes up and one morning, literally, it happens like this, and says, you know, I don't think my dad or my mom was evil or bad, you know, and I need to make amends. And I guess during the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of false accusations, as there still are now, but that's when it started. And so people are, they're damaged because the children have made, they go to prison, you know, with the child accusing the parent falsely. And so can you imagine a child doing this and then the child becomes a young adult and again, as I said, looks back back over their shoulder and over their history and says, you know, my father is really not that way. He's really very kind. I don't understand this. This must not be true. And then, you know, then it occurs. And then the, and in some cases, in fact, there's a wonderful book by Meredith Moran called My Lie, where she had to make amends to her, or she didn't have to, she decided to make amends to her father when she suddenly realized that he hadn't sexually molested her.
Yes.
And here, you know, he could have gone to jail because of the things that she said about him openly and in court and to other family members. And so at any rate, it's a story that she's a journalist, and it's a story about how she made amends with her family. But, you know, this happens a great deal more than we would like to think.
Yes, you mentioned the book was called My Lie, was it? Was that the name of the book?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And you're talking about the children might come to this realization. That would be very traumatic for them as well, I imagine, if they...
Yes, exactly. Exactly. What the brainwashing does is not just immediate. It's what it does to a person's future. And the idea that, like you said, it is cultic. And... you know, that they don't have the strength or the capability to get out of the cult, because the reward is for staying in the cult with that thinking.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of imprisoned, just like the prisoners of war sometimes.
Yes, and cult people do desperate things, don't they, which is another worry.
Yes, yes.
So you've started, your mission is now with the International Support Network for Alienated Families. It's a non-profit corporation. Do people come to you,
yes,
looking for advice, or how does it, what's the work generally of the network?
Did you just ask me what the work was?
Yes. Do people come to you for advice, or is the main work?
They can call. Actually, when they call, they get me.
Yeah.
that may change in the future because our group is expanding and we have now many not chapters, but they're resources in the different areas here in the States, the west of the Mississippi. So at any rate, yes. So how it works is that I speak to every person who is a candidate for an ISNAF group, the International Support Network for Alienated Families group. They have to be capable of contributing as well as taking feedback and connecting with others. This is not always the case when a parent has been traumatized. There are many times when a parent is much too anxious, and I recommend that they do some work outside for a bit, and I stay in touch with them, or another therapist will stay in touch with them, so when they do come to the group, that they are they benefit from it. Many of our parents have experienced PTSD, post traumatic stress syndrome. Many don't know that they have, but they have. They need to have goals that we can fulfill. For example, if they want good referrals of attorneys, of educators, of therapists, et cetera, and they come to us, we don't endorse anyone, but we sure know who has been trained and who knows about parental alienation syndrome. And who's had a good experience and who hasn't, and those are the best referrals, you know.
Yes.
We have a system of cohorts, what's called a system of cohorts. I love to be a matchmaker, and I feel that community is it. If you have a community, you're able to stay the course. You don't throw your hands up as easily, because most of our parents are in it for the long run, for the marathon rather than the sprint, you know, and we all would like this all to be over yesterday, but oftentimes it drags on and in the courts, and then afterwards you're dealing with all the aftermath, like I said, of the brainwashing and so forth that needs to get through. And sometimes it happens miraculously, people clear, but oftentimes it's not. So in order to stay in the fight or in the game, one needs to have other people standing around them, and the feeling of normalcy is important. You know, parents in this targeted parents don't feel normal. They don't feel like, for example, discipline their children. I mean, in terms of just setting limits, normal limits and boundaries, they're terrified they're going to lose their child over and over again. You know,
yes.
So at any rate, so.
Well, you've got a lot of work to do. And now, we're speaking with Karen Lebo, who's the founder of and CEO of President of ISNAF. Now, you've got a conference coming up in November, I think, on the 10th of November.
Yes, I believe that that's the date.
That's the is that the third national conference for ISNAF?
That would be the third national conference. Yes.
Well, that sounds exciting. Can you tell us anything about the conference?
Actually, it's in formulation right now. Mm-hmm. But for those people who want to contact us, we can stay in touch. I'd love to stay in touch, and we also. For people whose institutions like them to have certificates and credit, we offer that too, for whether it be that they work in the courts or with kids in other ways or parents and families, we offer that. And we know that we will have some great keynoters. In the past, we've had Amy Baker has come, of course, and Joshua Coleman, and some of these people I consider rock stars that nobody else has heard of. You know? We know who we are.
Yes.
But at any rate, suffice it to say, they're educated at the best universities, or what is known here as the best, and also they've had incredible experience in the topic of estrangement. So, and they come to us generally at a highly reduced fee or no fee at all. And I even had somebody from Toronto come in, a very well-known attorney, who came in and lectured and also paid his own way just to be part of this. It's almost like, it's not a movement, but it's kind of like that, because the idea that there are resources and they're so easy to obtain. There are charges for our events now, but it's something everyone can afford. If they can't, then we do not turn anyone away because they cannot pay. If people want to come to the conference, we can arrange for in-home hospitality, and we make it as easy as possible for people to come. And so if anyone wants to contact me, I have a phone number in the States. I'm not sure it would work for in Australia, but they can email Lebows, Lebows,
yes,
at isnaf.com.
Okay, that's ISNAF.
I'm going to take that. No, let's not do that one.
Okay.
I'm sorry. let's do just Lebows, Lebows, at yes. AOL.com.
Okay, Lebows, that's Lebows.
AOL.com.
Yes, AOL.com. And I think you've got a website as well?
Yes, we do. It's actually www.isnaf.info.
Great. So you can get in touch with Karen Lebo there at www.isnaf.info, and you can find
what
out...
It would be Lebows, Lebows, at AOL.com would be the email for me personally,
yes.
or you could contact us on our website. There, we have contact forms that you can fill out, and we do read them, and we do respond. So, and we respond pretty quickly too.
Look, that's great. And for anyone that's able to get to that, the national conference on the 10th of November, I think it's in November anyway, but it's somewhere around the 10th of November.
Right. It is in formulation right now. So, yeah. But we can keep people posted and to watch the website and or to give us a call. We don't mind. And to understand that this is a problem. This is an issue that the whole world faces.
It's
international.
Certainly does. It does. And yeah. Another person who's also been through it, I wonder if we're at that stage where I'd just like you to pick a song for us, Karen, and it's a very special song. I think by your friend Janice Vale.
I do appreciate the time and being able to speak this way with you and your audience.
Oh, thank you very much, Karen. And Karen, we're going to go to your special song now. This is "Icicles" by Janice Vale, and I think she's a friend of yours.
Janice Vale, yes. She actually is part of our network.
Great.
And an alienated mom,
Well, we'll go to her wonderful song. So, Karen, thank you very much for being on the program, and we wish you all the best for the work you're doing and for your conference in November.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen.
See you there.
Thank you.
Wake up in the morning, feeling strange. Weather's changed, it feels like frost. Wonder if you're warm and safe, if you have found a place, or if you're lost. Icicles that formed on rooftops, they adorn now, hit the ground. Little older, life's a whole lot colder now that you're not around. I will wait for you. I will wait for you. Snowflakes in the trees, the last few colors of the leaves make me want to stay. Loving voices plead, they're saying, we're just what you need, don't go away. Times I sit and dream, and it can seem you may never see the light.